wanted to measure gravitational waves, waving your arms around would be a really bad source.
1 + 1 does not equal 2. These ripples in space and time are so small.
Hello and welcome to the Supermassive Podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
Yeah, grab your space surfboards because this month it's all about gravitational waves. We're going to find out what they are and ask how the heck do you detect something so small?
And shout out to listener Michael Cleary, because he sent a question about gravitational waves a fair few months ago, and we decided that the topic needed a little bit more time than just one answer. So we'll get to it.
I would have been there forever otherwise. You'd have been like, shut up.
Just like, we got to just get the shepherd's crook comes out, like, shut up. And obviously, Dr. Robert Massey, the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society, is here. So, how excited are you about gravitational waves?
You know, one of the great things about being in astronomy for a few decades is you get to see things that you thought might be impossible become reality. And gravitational waves, the first detection of those in 2015 was one of those. I remember going to scientific meetings in 2000 where people were talking about building detectors that they knew probably wouldn't detect gravitational waves, and they had to do all the engineering, work through it all. And then finally, 2015, you see it happen. And when you think about it, this tiny shift in space-time, they're huge disturbances in space-time, but by the time they get to the Earth, this teeny tiny shift in the length of a detector that we're able to pick up, it's crazy, and we can do it. And it now offers us this completely new way of looking at the universe. So, you know, we think about light radio waves, X-rays, gamma rays, and that's all part of the electromagnetic spectrum and using telescopes and detectors of one type or another. And then particle physics, neutrinos coming through the Earth is a different window. And this is a completely different window again. So it's slowly but surely opening up an entirely new way of looking at the universe.
And I think when you'll hear the interviews from today, you'll just hear me going like, oh my gosh, okay, let me wrap my head around that, fine.
I love how, Robert, your memories are like from serious meetings that you were in about like gravitational wave detectors. My memory of like the very first gravitational wave detector is just everyone going around and greeting everyone in astronomy just like, all week, because that was like the noise that it made if you shifted it to like the waves to human hearing, it just made this little pop sound, so we would just walk around just being like, hey.
I don't know, you see, there was me thinking Oxford astrophysicists were all serious.
Not at all.
Okay, so gravitational waves are pretty tricky things to understand. So I asked for help from Professor Mark Hannam from Cardiff University. And Mark started by giving me a little lesson in gravity.
The way that we think about gravity now, which comes from Einstein, is this really strange idea that he had, that space and time are curved. And that's really hard to picture. But one way to think about it, which is in some way using gravity to explain gravity, but fine, which is if you're standing on a trampoline and the mat of the trampoline is stretched down, and then someone pushes a ball onto the trampoline, then it will sort of spiral around you and get closer and closer in, rather than rolling just straight across, which is what it would do if the mat was flat.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like what's happening with gravity, except that with gravity, it's actually space being stretched and time being slowed down. When you have objects moving through space, then the gravity around them is changing, and that change is going out into space as a ripple, as a wave in this stretching of space and time. If a gravitational wave was to pass through the room now, the distance between the walls would get slightly smaller and then slightly bigger and slightly smaller and slightly bigger without them moving.
Okay, you've just blown my mind just a little bit there.
And I think it's fair to say that is a completely bizarre concept.
Yeah.
I think when we're working on it, we forget how really bizarre it is. And the way I think about it is that it is a completely mad idea, and it would have been completely thrown out when Einstein suggested it, except that every single measurement we've ever done is consistent with that theory. So we just have to live with it.
Okay. So are we saying that everything could give off a gravitational wave? If it's just gravity,
yes,
then everything can give off
everything that has mass, has produces gravity. And so, yeah, if you're waving your arms around, that's producing gravitational waves.
Okay.
They're just really, really weak, because gravity is the weakest of the forces we know. And these gravitational waves are just this tiny sort of perturbation on top of gravity. So they're ridiculously weak. So if you wanted to measure gravitational waves, waving your arms around would be a really bad source.
Okay, so what are some of the better sources then to measure? Because if they are so weak, I'm assuming then that you need something massive to actually be able to even begin to detect these gravitational waves.
Right. You want to come up with the most violent accelerations of matter you can think of. And that's why we look into space and we look, for example, collisions of black holes, because black holes have a huge amount of mass compressed into a tiny region. And then if you take two of them, they can orbit each other very closely, very rapidly. And that's the strongest source of gravitational waves we can imagine. And so that's where we go to look for them.
Can you talk me through that event? We talk about the collision of two black holes, but we've also seen them with two neutron stars colliding. Talk me through what's happening with them that we then pick up these ripples in space-time.
Okay, so two black holes, they're in orbit and they very slowly spiral into each other. But this gets faster and faster as they get closer. They orbit faster. They give off more gravitational waves. They go yet faster again. And so this thing speeds up until they finally make contact and merge into one black hole.
And I was watching videos of, you know, simulations of what this would look like. And do you know what the movement really reminds me of is, I don't know if, I mean, I hope listeners did this as children, but you'd go into McDonald's and they had those machines where you drop a penny in and it would start going around the side of the machine and then slowly mm-hmm. circle in and in, and it goes, as it gets into the center, it goes really, really, really fast. That's sort of like the movement that we see of if you put two coins in at the same time and they sort of get into the center at the same point. That's essentially the movement that we're seeing of these merging, you know, whatever, massive objects, right?
Right. That's a really good analogy of what they're doing. Is you can think of that bowl as like the curvature of space and time.
And so if we're talking about waves here, does that mean that as they get closer and closer together, we're seeing the waves, these ripples, get bigger and bigger and yeah. more frequent as well?
No, the waves do get, the signal gets louder, which is the right term to use, because they're at, when we detect them, they're actually at frequencies of sound waves. So they really are like sounds, and the detectors are like microphones. So yeah, the signals are getting louder as the black holes spiral together. And the signal, this is called a chirp signal. The way in which the sound rises is like a chirp. And so you can go on the internet and you can find sound bites of people having simulated black holes, and they go sort of whoop.
Oh my gosh, I love that. That's so good. And so you mentioned at the very beginning of this that this has something to do with Einstein, who predicted these in the early 1900s. So how did he know that this might be in effect?
So he'd come up with his theory of special relativity, which says that nothing can go faster than the speed of light. And once he'd done that, he realized, well, gravity is a problem, because in Newton's theory of gravity, gravity just goes, pump, it's everywhere in the universe instantly. And if you move something, the gravitational field everywhere just changes instantly. So it's obviously something's happening faster than the speed of light. So that can't be right. So he needed to fix Newton's gravity in some sense. And so in doing that, he came up with a theory. And one of the things that dropped out was that if you have some very small change to your gravitational field and you look how that behaves, it will behave like a wave. And but when he did that, he thought that they wouldn't be detectable because they are so weak.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay, so he even with all of this, he knew that it would be an incredibly weak signal to try and find. And so obviously we've moved on since the early 1900s, so we have been able to detect gravitational waves. So how did that change over time? You know, what were the efforts that really transformed studying gravitational waves?
Well, one of the big things was this observation of these two neutron stars that were in a binary system, and they were observed to be very, very slowly moving together. at a rate that exactly agreed with Einstein's theory. And so that showed that gravitational waves were real. And then, of course, much more recently, we've now directly detected gravitational waves with the LIGO and Virgo detectors since 2015. And so that was the real transformation
of the topic. And what was that like in 2015 when that measurement came through? For you, you know, in particular working in this field.
It was amazing because the detectors had been upgraded over a few years to be more sensitive and they were about to be turned on. And we thought, okay, this time we might see something, but probably it will take a few years before that happens. And a day after they were turned on, the first signal came through. So it was just incredible. I didn't believe it. Lots of people didn't believe it. We thought, okay, they've just turned these on. There's going to be problems. There's going to be confusion. And it was really only a few weeks later that I was finally convinced and that everyone had checked everything and they were real. And then it was just incredible.
Now, I don't mean to seem rude when I ask this, but what is the point of measuring gravitational waves?
That's a good question because, I mean, gravitational waves are really the least significant thing we have ever measured in human history because they've made the smallest effect we've ever measured. But what they're telling us about is about black holes and out in the universe and neutron stars. And from that, we can learn how those stars formed. And that tells us about how the universe evolved. From neutron stars, we'll eventually be able to measure the signals from those, from neutron star mergers. We'll have to measure the signals so well that they will tell us about nuclear physics inside the neutron stars to densities that we can't dream of producing in the laboratory. We've learned a lot from gravitational waves so far, but we haven't yet had our understanding of the universe overturned, but it's sure to come.
That was Mark Hannam from Cardiff University. I love that he said what a mad idea gravitational waves are. I think that I was just fully there in that interview, like, okay, don't worry about shifts in space-time. That's totally fine.
I agree.
And actually, we have the sound of a gravitational wave chirp. This is what happens when two black holes collided.
See? Sounds just like...
Yes, it's exactly.
They should have done that in the press briefing, shouldn't they, really?
So we are going to get onto how we detect gravitational waves in a moment. But Becky, what have we actually learned from detecting them?
I mean, a lot. How long's a piece of string, really, is he? Like, first of all, we've been able to test, you know, general relativity, Einstein's best theory of gravity, within an inch of its life with all of these detections that we've made. You know, we've been taking predictions from models on what the shape of sort of these waves look like by the time they reach Earth, like what we should actually detect, and all those models seem to hold up. They're based on general relativity. We've confirmed that, and I like to express this as 1 + 1 = 2. We've confirmed, because when you measure two black holes merging, you know, they could have a mass of, like, say one has a mass of 10 times the mass of the sun and one has 15 times the mass of the sun. You think you'd get out a black hole of 25 times the mass of the sun, but you don't. Get one out that's just a bit less than that, because some of the mass and energy are equivalent, E = mc². So some of the mass of the two black holes goes into the energy that's needed to radiate away the gravitational waves, which I just love that 1%.
Yeah, okay.
Time. We've also learned that the speed of gravity is the same as the speed of light. So one of the events that LIGO detected was 170817, a famous number now for astronomers. So it's called a kilonova. So it wasn't black hole mergers, but two neutron stars that merged together. And so we detected actually light from that merger across the entire sort of electromagnetic spectrum, like x-rays, optical, gamma, everything, but then also gravitational waves. And we wouldn't have ID'd it for what it was if it wasn't for the gravitational waves. And if we study it across all of these wavelengths, we learn a lot about, you know, like heavy element production, like where does all the gold come from? And it's from neutron star mergers. And also, these neutron star mergers are what's known as a standard candle. If you remember your cosmology, Izzy, they're the same.
Oh my God, I have not heard that term for so long. Yeah,
so they're the same brightness wherever they go off. So you can use them to get at the distance of whatever galaxy they went off in. So in this case, it was NGC 4993.
Oh, wow.
And so you can get the distance of that galaxy independent of any other method, which means you can get at an expansion rate of the universe independent of any other method. And if you remember, there's a bit of a hoo-ha going on over there that two of the main ways that we measure that do not agree at the minute. So people got excited, like, oh, we can use this gravitational wave discovery to measure the expansion rate of the universe. Of course, it turned out to be smack bang in the middle of the two that don't
disagree.
Oh, good, so good. It's a bit annoying. But it can help us teach us about that. But this idea that gravitational waves have sort of traverse at the speed of light, so gravity has the same speed as the speed of light, it means they're also affected, you know, by the expansion of the universe as well, the curvature of space-time, you know, caused by other heavy objects. They experience time dilation as well. And the implications of all that is that essentially there must be this quantum theory of gravity where you have this particle that sort of communicates what is the strength of gravity. And we call that a graviton, seems like the photon for light, behaving as this quantum particle. So it has really interesting implications, all of these stuff that we've learned from gravitational waves about, you know, what is gravity and how we describe it. I mean, quantum theory of gravity has been like physics bucket list for a very long time.
And I think it's incredible that you can take something so massive, like the most massive objects in our universe, to then come down, and it then takes it down onto the tiniest level, you know, quantum level. I don't think we're going to do an episode on that. TBC.
Probably a bit out of mine and Robert's wheelhouse.
Someone else can cover that topic.
We'll leave that to Brian.
Yeah, exactly. But do they tell us anything? Have we learned anything new about, I don't know, characterizing massive objects themselves?
More like massive and very dense rather than just massive, because obviously a galaxy is a massive object, right? But it's very, very dense. So it's very much sort of neutron stars and black holes. We can sort of ask questions like, you know, does the curvature of space around them behave the same as sort of mass a gradient, or does becoming a black hole change it completely? You know, a black hole is different in some way. But the thing is, we're still really limited with LIGO to this certain mass range of black holes and neutron stars that we can look at. You know, we look at what we call the stellar mass range, so similar in mass to stars, so anywhere from sort of 1 times the mass of the sun, if you're sort of an up if you're a neutron star, up to like 100 times the mass of the sun. Not like supermassive black holes.
Yeah, okay.
Which
okay.
is the stuff, you know, that I, you know, really think about.
That's the thing that you're waiting for. You're like,
yeah, exactly. And I am waiting fairly impatiently for that, because we need a bigger detector for this. So I think we're going to hear in a little bit about, you know, how we actually detect gravitational waves. But essentially, the size of your detector limits the frequency of the waves you can detect. And you know, the bigger the object you get, the frequency that changes.
So as I discussed with Mark earlier, on the 14th of September 2015, scientists detected a gravitational wave signal for the very first time from 2 merging black holes, 100 years on from Albert Einstein's prediction of gravitational waves. But these ripples in space and time are so small. We're talking fractions of the width of a proton, small. So how do scientists detect them? And just how difficult is it? It's something that I put to Professor Sheila Rowan, director of the Institute for Gravitational Research at the University of Glasgow.
The fact that they're tiny, they are very hard to detect because they don't interact with very much. And so that means that the challenge for us is being able to build instruments in the end that are sensitive enough to detect stretching and squashing of space-time, what feels to us like changes in distance of isolated objects, the mirrors in our detectors, that are less than a thousandth of the diameter of a subatomic particle.
These signals are just so tiny. So how do you go about measuring them and detecting them? Because fundamentally, we're talking about tiny ripples in space and time.
The way we detect gravitational waves is using a technique called laser interferometry. And based on what's called a Michelson-type interferometer, something that folks who've studied physics at university will recognise from their undergraduate physics classes.
Yeah, I'm having flashbacks of that.
And the principle is that we take light from a laser, highly stabilised in intensity and in frequency. We send that towards a beam splitter. The beam splitter splits that light in two, directs it along two paths that are at right angles to one another. So you can think of the light wave travelling distances along those arms. The light waves reach mirrors at the ends of the interferometer arms, and the light wave is then reflected back, travelling back towards the beam splitter. And as those waves arrive at the beam splitter, they either add up together, two peaks arrive together, and two peaks in the light, of course, makes a bright spot. Or if something has changed differentially the length of the arms of our instrument, the waves may, for instance, arrive back from one arm with a peak and the other arm with a trough. Those then cancel out and we'd get a dark spot. So what that kind of device does, it uses light to accurately measure the length of the paths that the light travel. If the mirrors at the ends of our arms move, then we see that by looking at the changes in the intensity of the light detected. Gravitational waves have the effect, as they pass through our instrument, of differentially changing the lengths of the arms of the instrument. That's the signature of a gravitational wave. So effectively, one arm length would be stretched, the other would be squashed, and we would look for that signature, that change in arm length, by looking at the intensity of the light at the output of the detector. So that's the principle in which they work. In truth, there's a lot of instrumentation in there, a lot of other tricks to make that even more sensitive.
So on a really basic level, and I mean really basic, we're looking at, is this laser still in sync or has something, gravitational waves, changed it? But the difference with any laser experiments that I ever did at undergrad was that I could fit them on a table. And LIGO and observatories like it are massive. So do you want to explain what they look like?
So our instruments are large. In this case, the longer our arm lengths, the more sensitive our instruments are to gravitational waves. So there are a number of these instruments, these observatories around the world. In the US, there are the LIGO observatories. So there are two instruments, one in Hanford in Washington State, one in Livingston in Louisiana, and their arms are 4 kilometres long. So if you approach one of these observatories, you would see a big building in the middle, which is about the size of a big supermarket, looks about that size. And going out from that central building, you would see two arms with sort of concrete covers, each of which disappears off 4 kilometres into the distance, with another little buildings at the end that contain the mirrors in them.
Okay, so that's the LIGO observatories in America, but we see similar observatories around the world, don't we?
So there are several gravitational wave observatories around the globe, and there are good scientific reasons for that, actually. So in Europe, there's the Virgo Observatory in Italy, but actually is operated by a consortium of European partners, various different countries. And in fact, there's another observatory too. There's the Kagra Observatory in Japan. And that's important. It's important we have multiple observatories and that they are geographically separated. Multiple reasons for that. First of all, for that first detection, it helped us a lot to see it in multiple instruments. But actually, scientifically, one observatory has some sensitivity to gravitational waves from almost everywhere in the sky. Not quite, but actually, it's more like a microphone than a telescope, which is good in some ways. But on the other hand, it means you don't know exactly where your gravitational wave signal came from in the sky. If you have two observatories, then you can start to time when a gravitational wave signal arrived first at one observatory and then the other. So knowing the timing, we can start to use triangulation to work backwards to point. You don't do terribly well, though, only with two observatories. There's still quite a bit of uncertainty about where in the sky. So the more observatories you have, you then can pin down with higher and higher accuracy where in the sky a gravitational wave signal has come from, and give that information usefully to observers with telescopes who can then turn their telescopes to point and look for any corresponding electromagnetic signal. So it's scientifically important that we have multiple instruments.
And because you're looking for such small signals, do you have to be really careful of how these instruments are isolated? I imagine, you know, if someone goes stomping around near the detectors, that's going to create a vibration that will then change the signal. So how do you protect these instruments?
So we work very hard to isolate our mirrors in the instrument from external things that might disturb them. And there's a lot of technology involved. So we talked about how tiny these changes are in the relative positions of these mirrors. To help you visualise, in the LIGO observatories, they are 40 kilogram mirrors. They are right circular cylinders. They look like big pieces of glass. It's very pure fused silica. And we do need to isolate those. You can imagine if you just put one on the ground shakes. It shakes naturally, background seismic vibrations, or someone could, you know, as you say, drop something nearby, cause the ground to shake. So we have to make sure that the mirrors are isolated from those kinds of seismic disturbances. So one of the things we do is we suspend those mirrors at the bottom of pendulums. The laser beams that we send out don't travel through air. They actually are going along inside vacuum pipes so that air molecules passing through the laser beams don't disturb the laser beams as they travel along the arms. The mirrors have to point in a particular direction. We're using laser light that can be absorbed by the mirrors themselves. So we have to put highly reflective coatings on the mirrors to make sure that, the laser light is reflected back. So there's a whole set of technological developments that have been research carried out over decades.
And this is the case where bigger is very much better. So will we see even more gravitational wave observatories with even longer arms in the future, do you think?
For quite a long time in the field, and colleagues both in Europe and the US and internationally have been thinking about a next step by building new instruments, tackling some of those noise sources in different ways we could do much better. So in Europe, for quite a long time now, there's been a vision for a next generation observatory called the Einstein Telescope, which instead of a 3 kilometre arms would be up to 10 kilometre arms. That enhances the sensitivity of the instrument, potentially underground, actually to reduce the effects of some of those low frequency noise sources, the seismic noise, because that decreases as you go underground. Part of that instrument might be cooled to low temperatures. And in the US, there's a vision again for a future generation instrument called Cosmic Explorer, which could be up to 40 kilometres. And these would have a step change in terms of the capabilities of detecting gravitational waves, potentially detecting the collision of stellar mass black holes out to the edge of the universe. No black hole left behind. So these are exciting prospects for the future of the field.
Big thanks to Sheila Rowan from the University of Glasgow.
So far, we've talked about ground-based observatories, but what about having one out in space, you know, away from any noise and disruption?
There are plans in the work for a space-based gravitational wave detector from ESA, the European Space Agency, which is called LISA. And that'll have a detector as long as 2.5 million kilometres. For context, that's about 6.5 times the Earth-Moon distance. So it's going to be very, very big. It's not going to launch until 2037, still in the design phase and everything. So we do have to be fairly patient. But then we'll learn really about sort of what happens when the most massive and dense objects in the universe merge with supermassive black holes. This is the Supermassive Podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Sethurst, and with science journalist Izzy Clark.
This month, it's all about gravitational waves, so let's get to our listener questions. And just a little caveat from me, quite a few of our questions referred to calling them gravity waves, but I feel like it's better to call them gravitational waves. That's more correct. Becky, can you explain that? Yeah?
Yeah, that's like, they're actually two completely different things. Gravitational waves are the ripples through space-time from these cataclysmic events, but a gravity wave would almost be not really a wave necessarily, but almost like a stronger field of gravity moving through space for whatever reason. Like, you almost hear about it in sci-fi more than you do in actual scientific
okay
pros necessarily. It's like, oh, there's a gravity wave coming where the gravity is going to increase and everyone sort of gets flattened to the floor or whatever. Yeah, so gravity wave, gravitational wave, they're not really interchangeable.
Okay, so gravitational waves it is. And I think we have to start with the one that kicked off the entire reason for us doing this episode. I'm Michael. I am so sorry that it's taken us so long to get to this one question. So Becky, Michael Cleary asks, do gravitational waves interact with each other like intersecting waves on an ocean? Could large numbers of very big things moving around form standing gravitational waves, like in a fancy wave chamber? Is that a factor in why galaxies are so weird?
Well, Michael, it's been a long time coming, but here we go. Now, you would think so, that this could happen, that gravitational waves can interfere with each other, sort of cancel each other out or add together to make like a wave twice as big as the ones that came in. And that is true to a point, but they won't pass through each other and add together like waves on an ocean will, just interfering with each other, because they will also interact. So remember before, I was talking about how we think that the best way of describing gravity would be this quantum theory of gravity with this particle called the graviton. Now, admittedly, haven't worked this out yet. We don't have a sort of, you know, legit theory of quantum gravity yet. People are still working on it. You know, people will get there eventually, but we don't have
TBC,
it yet.
TBC.
But we know, that at least from what we've learned about gravitational waves so far, that it's very likely that there is this quantum theory of gravity with these gravitons. So because we have gravitons, we know that there's this particle that's responsible for creating gravity and causing sort of the strength of gravity and doing all this interaction that communicates that. It means that as gravitational waves meet, you don't just get a wave interacting with each other and adding together. You would also get graviton-graviton interactions. So you'd get scattering and you'd get collisions as well. And that would affect how the two waves would interfere with each other. So it wouldn't be like the sort of sound wave constructive interference that we're used to in sort of like noise-canceling headphones, or like Michael gave the example of like ocean waves or anything like that. What actually would happen, we don't have a full picture yet because we don't have a quantum theory of gravity to tell us. But at least by detecting gravitational waves, it could give us more constraints for our theories of quantum gravity for, you know, people trying to track this. So I think that's a no, unfortunately, to standing waves, standing gravitational waves, Michael. And no, that I think that would mean it wouldn't have any issue in terms of like the weirdness of galaxies. I don't know what you're talking about in terms of the weirdness of galaxies. It's very lots of
just
weird,
weird
things, but you
they're
know, I think I don't think it might be gravitational waves in the end.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Becky.
I hope that was worth it after so many months, Michael. That the answer was no. Sorry.
No. Okay, so Robert, David Charlotte asks, are gravitational wave detectors just for black hole and supernova collisions, or are there other things detectable?
Yeah, I mean, the main reason we talk about those things, well, actually, you talk about black hole and neutron stars colliding in the main, but the main reason we talk about things like that is because these gravitational waves, by the time they get to the vicinity of the Earth, they're so teeny tiny that you need these massively dramatic events to generate them in the first place. So, you know, they have to be incredibly powerful to generate something we can actually detect here on Earth. That, so in theory, lots of other things will generate gravitational waves. It's just that they're so tiny, we've got virtually no chance of ever picking them up. So, but there are other examples. I mean, one thing is a supernova explosion, which if it happens in the right way, if it's not perfectly symmetric, which seems rather unlikely, then that would generate a load of gravitational waves as well. It should be possible to pick those up. I don't think we've done that yet. Becky, feel free to dive in here if I'm wrong about that, but I don't think anything's happened yet. But it should be possible if you get a very powerful supernova. But we can also see more subtle influence of them. Now, that doesn't mean we're detecting them directly, but the example I could think of was that when you look at neutron star binaries that we saw, you know, quite a long time ago, as long ago as the 1970s, there was the Horst-Taylor pulsar detected. So pulsars are pulsating neutron stars. And the researchers looking at that were able to measure the fact that the two neutron stars were slowly spiraling in towards each other because they were losing energy as gravitational waves. And that was in line with Einstein's general theory of relativity as well. So we sort of knew they were there. And that was why there was such a huge, or part of the reason, I guess, why there was a huge effort to build all these detectors, because they're very difficult things to do. But that kind of evidence led us to believe it was possible to pick them up. So we see their influence indirectly quite a lot as well.
Okay.
Do you know what I love as well? The history, like after that discovery in the 70s and 80s, the amount of people that were like, I have built a gravitational wave detector. I have detected gravitational waves. And you're like, no, you haven't. No one can replicate what you've done. Like, it was so, like, the amount of people that, you know, in false claims there were just because that discovery just kickstarted just this, like, furore of gravitational waves.
But yeah, and it is that craziness, isn't it? You know, just imagine, I mean, you know, I know a long time ago, but sitting in meetings with people, we're building this generation of detectors, but they won't detect anything. Yeah. So we're just getting them better and better, and then eventually we'll get some that work.
Yeah. Okay. Becky, Samir wants to know, are there gravitational waves that are resonating continuously from the expansion of the Big Bang?
Yes, Samir, we think so. We call them cosmological gravitational waves. And like the, you know, the cosmic microwave background, that sort of radiation that we detect from all regions of the sky, we think they would come from every single direction of the sky, should be arriving at us constantly. We never detected them before, but they are a prediction of the Big Bang theory, of how the universe has evolved. The problem is they're a very different frequency from what our current detectors are sensitive to. So they're a very high frequency with a smaller wavelength, and then by the time they get to us, obviously they're very, very low amplitude. They've been traversing through the entire universe. The frequency is actually proportional as well to the size of the universe when the gravitational waves were emitted. So if you have a smaller universe, you have a smaller wavelength and therefore a higher frequency. And so there are actually plans for LISA, the space-based gravitational wave detector, to be sensitive to some of these frequencies, and in particular to the ones that would be given out in the era of inflation. So I think we've covered this on the podcast before, but this is the idea that, like, you know, within a fraction of a second, like at the tiniest of billionths of a second, the universe expanded to billions of billions of billions of times its current size very early on in sort of the very first, you know, 3 seconds of the universe, we think this would happen. And that's what sort of imprinted the same conditions across the entire universe and makes it sort of so, you know, looking the same in every direction when we look out. So I think if you consider what classes as a cataclysmic event, inflation, like, you know, definitely comes under that in the way that, you know, black hole mergers do as well. So it's really important to understand inflation. It's been a sort of, you know, a theory for a while to explain what we see. But if we could detect gravitational waves from it, that would be the first sort of observational, you know, direct observational evidence we have of it, not just like an indirect evidence. And it's really important because, you know, the universe at that time was opaque to light. We're never going to get light from that time. It's absorbed by all the material around it. So gravitational waves would be the only way that we could probe this. So I think it's another reason why people are very excited about LISA.
Yeah. And we definitely did cover the beginning of the universe and inflation. Oh, yeah. New Year, New Universe, our 13th ever episode. So go back through the archives and find that one.
You want to know more about inflation?
There we go. Robert Chatty Chooks on Twitter asks, do you think it's possible for two gravitational waves to cancel each other out? Should we use a word other than waves to describe them?
Well, Chatty Chooks, I'm going to refer you to Dr. Smethurst's earlier answer about the complexity of the interaction of gravitational waves here. So I think the caveat is probably not from everything she was describing. Should we use a word other than waves to describe them? Well, I mean, you could certainly think of it as this kind of propagating disturbance. So just as maybe we think about, you know, a tidal wave as being like a wave, it seems reasonable to talk about them in those terms to me. Who knows, maybe we'll come up with a better word, but I don't know, a lot of the other alternatives just don't seem to cut it, really, do they? I mean, pulse or something, or disturbance is a bit boring, isn't it? It sounds like a bit of noise on a Friday night or something like that.
I can see Becky's got her thinking face on. She's like looking into the distance like, what would I
can see she's exactly, she's thinking about a paper and a new term, right?
What is it? Space is hard, words are harder, right? Waves is the best analogy we probably could come up with.
Ah, and breathe. Questions, darling. I think my mind has bent so many times this episode. And thank you for everyone who sent in questions. If you want to send any in for a future episode, maybe a bit easier than this topic, then you can email podcast@ras.ac.uk, tweet at Royal Astrosoc, or slide into the DMs on Instagram. It's at supermassivepod.
Yeah, I like that idea. Slide into the DMs, the supermassive pod box.
Yes. This supermassive just inserts it into so many things. The supermassive mailbox. Yeah. Anyway. I think, Robert, we should probably move on to something a bit easier than gravitational waves. What can we see in the night sky this month?
Couldn't agree more. Probably somewhat easier, you know, bending our mind as well as the fabric of the universe. So what can we see? Well, look, we're finally moving into spring. And so you've still got the winter constellations like Orion are still there, but we start to see more stuff too. And if you look above Orion, for example, you've got Gemini, the zodiac constellations, really obvious above it. It looks like a sort of long box with the bright stars Castor and Pollux at one end. And I thought, I was thinking about things to look at. Actually, Castor, if you have a small telescope, is a fabulous example of no fewer than six stars in a multiple star system, all moving around each other at different rates. And it's actually sort of three binary stars in orbit around each other as well. A fiendishly complicated system. And you can actually see them. You can see the three pairs. You don't see them resolved as pairs, but see three stars, and then you can look at them knowing that they're also pairs too. One of them is this red dwarf star further out, but most small telescopes will help you find that quite easily. And then a bit beyond Gemini, further to the east, is the quite faint constellation of Cancer, which I mention because it's got this beautiful open star cluster, Messier 44, or Precipi, the beehive, and that's visible actually with the naked eye if it's sufficiently dark where you are. And it's one of those objects where actually having a pair of binoculars rather than a telescope is an advantage, because you see the whole sort of jewel box of stars, and if you have a telescope, you're only able to see a bit of it because it's quite a big thing. And over in the western sky, we're slowly losing pretty much now Saturn. Mars is fading out and it's moving down towards the west as well as the seasons go on, and Jupiter the same. But Venus is becoming much more obvious, and that will be, you know, clearer and clearer, higher in the skies than over the next few months. And if you're driving home at sunset and you see this ridiculous bright thing on the horizon, that's Venus, and it's going to get better and better. But before Jupiter goes completely, on the 1st and 2nd of March, the two planets will be really close together. It should be very photogenic. It's the kind of thing where they won't look like a single object to your eye, but they'll be really close. And if you pick up a pair of binoculars, you'll see the moons around Jupiter and Venus next to it. The two brightest planets, pretty much, so a really nice sight then. And spring is also a really, really good time to be looking out, looking at the moon, because it's really nice in the evening sky in the spring months because we're in the northern hemisphere and that's how it moves through the zodiac. So if you're looking out the next few months, but for example, in the next week or so, late February, early March, there is a beautiful crescent coming to the first quarter moon. And you can see things like the Earth shine. So do look out for that too. That's a phenomenon where you get the crescent moon, the brightly lit thing, thinking of Becky's reference to a particular type of moon. And
move on quick.
the darker bit of it, the bit that's not in sunlight at that point, is lit up by the light from the Earth. So sunlight reflects off the Earth onto it in this lovely thing called Earth shine, which is sometimes referred to as the new moon in the old moon's arms.
I've never heard that before. That's beautiful.
Lovely. And I also want to say thank you to listener Chris, who also goes by Catching Photons, because he attempted to look at the comet that we've had in our night skies recently, and it's brilliant. And that was all because we talked about it last month. So I will put that on Instagram at some point. I will do that. It will be there soon.
You have got it. I should say you've got a little bit of time left to see the comet as well, although it is getting fainter now.
You need some decent kit to see it, don't you?
From memory, it's going down near Orion. Yeah, you definitely need a good pair of binoculars now, and it is fading out. But there will be more comets.
Well, I think that's it for this month in that case. And we'll be back next time with a look at Jupiter.
Were we just not looking at Saturn on purpose now, or?
Yeah, I'll see how I feel.
Is it... You're teasing me. Izzy. When will we look at Saturn? No, I'm excited to look at Jupiter. I'm very, very excited. I'm excited for the experts we're going to have as well. So get into it if you have a question for the team. It's at Royal Astrosoc on Twitter, or you can email your questions to podcast@ras.ac.uk, and we'll try and cover them in a future episode. But until then, everybody, happy stargazing.